Project Ignite Sessions, where innovation, technology, and entrepreneurship meet the brightest minds, leaders, and innovators in Colorado, our university ecosystem, and abroad. From the Project Ignite headquarters on the University of Denver campus, this is the Project Ignite Sessions, where all things innovation, technology, and entrepreneurship are explored. I'm the executive director of Project Ignite here on the University of Denver. My name is Eric Matisic. Today, I have two wonderful guests, Sierra Blem, our student advisory board member for Project Ignite, and one of the founders of Craftseed, one of our leading Colorado companies, Josh Scott. So Josh, really excited to have you here today. You know, your business is one of the most exciting places for our students and our alumni and everyone to really engage in here in the community. Tell us a little bit, most of all, about Josh. Like, you know, where are you originally from? How'd you become a founder of one of the hottest companies in the state? And, you know, what's your history?
Thank you. So super excited to be here. Background. So I grew up in Detroit, went to University of Michigan as an undergrad. And moved from the Detroit area to Chicago for a couple of years where I worked at Bain & Company as a consultant. And then started a company with a couple other people from Bain and moved it circa 1999 out to San Francisco along with everybody else and got caught up in that wave and stayed in San Francisco for a decade working on a whole bunch of things, including working at eBay for a number of years. While I was at eBay, I worked really closely with a guy, John Levesay, who became a really good friend of mine. And John's wife is from Denver, and he moved here with her a little bit preceding the birth of their first kid. And he called me up not that long after he got here, and he said, would you ever consider moving to Denver and starting something with me? And I said, starting something with you sounds great, but I'm not moving to Denver. And he said, how about you come visit? And I said, okay, I'll come visit. And 8 years later, I'm here and have been here ever since. And we started Craftseed not super long after I got here. Worked briefly together at Home Advisor, which is a fantastic company as well, and learned a ton and built great relationships there. And ended up starting Craftseed not just with John, but also with two other folks who are wonderful people as well from Home Advisor, Todd Tobin and Brett Hanna.
Awesome. So when you were just starting your career, you came out of undergrad and worked at Bain. Bain is one of the most prestigious consulting companies. How did you make the switch from going into consulting at Bain and then really deciding that you wanted to start a company and move to San Francisco?
Yeah, I think for my whole life, I've always wanted to be an entrepreneur in one way or another. And I ended up at Bain very accidentally. Literally, I don't think I'd ever heard of the company before. They came on campus to recruit. And it seemed like a great place to get a foundational underpinning of analytical skills and business rigor and a way to think about problems. And also a great way to build a network of people that I may end up wanting to start something with over time. And I was lucky because it proved out to be exactly that. It was a fantastic career experience, particularly in retrospect. And met some wonderful people there who had an entrepreneurial spark as well. And we ended up starting what was a sort of online insurance business and went from there.
How did you go from an online insurance business to Craftseed? And how did you find the spark to really not only visit Denver, but stay in Denver and grow the business to what it is today with three other guys?
Yeah, certainly. So Denver really appealed to me from the moment I first arrived. From the standpoint that in addition to, or very related to my love of building companies, this feels like a ecosystem that's on the upswing and has an opportunity to have folks have a real impact on its growth and development. And so in addition to having the opportunity to potentially build a company here, I felt like I had an opportunity to, you know, continue to stand on the shoulders of all the folks who have come before here and built great things, but continue to build and grow and develop a nice ecosystem. And Craftseed specifically, John and I spent a lot of time along with Todd and Brett thinking about things that we were passionate about, opportunities that we felt like were out there in the landscape that were ready for additional attention. And we all had a shared passion for education and felt like at the time, and it's hard to sort of rewind back 7 years to the time that we were thinking about this, the state of the art of online education at that time was was sad and disappointing. It was literally a single camera in the back of an MIT classroom. And that just couldn't be what online education had the potential to become. And we felt like technology trends were really in our favor. So everything from broadband adoption to video cameras were getting dramatically cheaper at the professional quality. And so there's just felt like the right factors were coming together at the right time to do something in online education, but we weren't sure what. And so we set out to do a whole bunch of experiments to figure out what that could be. And eventually that became Craftsy.
So Craftsy, I mean, I even wonder if I, you know, Craftsy is a word. I mean, how'd you come up with that? And I think it'd be great. And we've said it a few times, but you know, what is Craftsy? What's the business? It's online education. You guys spend a bunch of time thinking about how to reinvent it, but you know, what's the business?
Yeah. So the business of Craftsy is we are an online education and e-commerce business focused on meeting the needs of passionate creative enthusiasts. So people who love to quilt or cake decorate or knit or bake or sew or cook. 16 categories across a wide range of areas, but all within the broad area of creative passion.
So when you look at when you and John and the other founders were just initially starting to sit down, you know, what was that big catalytic part of like, okay, we're leaving Service Magic tomorrow. Yeah. We're going to go do this. And what was the first step you took?
Yeah, first step we took was getting together and really fleshing out what the problem was that we were excited to go work on. I always think that, you know, when you're starting to think about a business, the best way to think about it, at least in my experience, is team first, problem second, solution third. Because the solution that you have, in our case especially, and I'm not that lucky, so it doesn't break this way, is almost always wrong. And so you want to have a team of people that you're really passionate about going to work with every day, and a problem space that is big enough and interesting enough that you can stumble around in the dark for a while until you find something that really starts to take. And the early days of Craftsy, or what became Craftsy, were unequivocally stumbling around in the dark. So we started the company as Simpose, which was a horrible name, but was the best name that we could come up with that actually had an available domain name for us that had something to do with the kind of education we were thinking about. Short for symposium, and the thought process was that we wanted to take the magic of what happens in a traditional classroom where you learn as much from the interaction with your peers as you do from the pre-prepared lecture material from your instructor. And we thought that we could, through some technology, bring that to life online in an interesting way. But we had two real problems that were potentially insurmountable. One, we didn't know who would care. And two, everybody we talked to about this idea was like, you weird people don't understand that nobody pays for content on the internet. That's going to be a real problem for you. And so I think one of the luckiest things, best things that we did was we said, okay, if that's going to be the problem that's going to kill us, let's have it kill us really fast. So rather than coming out with a free product, we came out with a relatively expensive product in the grand scheme of things and tried to iterate and iterate and iterate until we landed on a product experience and a customer set that would match in a way that people would be willing to pay for it and prove to ourselves that it was worth coming to work every day and working on this problem and that really for some kinds of content, people would pay for content on the internet.
You mentioned knitting, basket weaving, all sorts of arts and crafts. Is this something that you and John and your other founders are steeped in, or is this something that truly was that, you know, walking in the dark product market fit that you've just been able to execute a business?
Yeah, this will come as a great shock to you, but neither John, Brett, Todd, nor I have a deep background in quilting or knitting. We do come from families that, you know, love each of those things. But this has been one of the secret wonderful things about the business is we've had to collectively have the forced humility that comes from building a company around something that candidly, at the start, we didn't know very much of anything about. So when we made a quilting class amongst many of the classes we initially made as experiments, and it really worked, we had a whoa moment where we pulled up and said, okay, we have a small team, just a few of us, and a small amount of money in the bank. We need to focus. So we're going to become a quilting business or something that looks like a quilting business. Uh-oh, we don't really know what that means even. Let's go out and spend a lot of time talking to customers or potential customers about what their needs are and really trying to understand that in a way that I don't think we could have if we were focused on a topic that we thought we knew quite a lot about.
So going off of the quilting and knitting, when I was 7, I learned how to knit with my great aunt. Mm-hmm. And so with Craftsy, how do you make these long-held practices that I tend to connect with, you know, the older generations or those who did it as a means to really provide for their families? How do you make it trendy to younger generations now and individuals who look at it as more of a like an experiment or something that can become a hobby?
Great question. So we're lucky from the standpoint that you're not alone in the fact that you learned this from an older member of your family. We feel like a lot of these areas that we cover, a lot of these areas of passion, really skipped a generation. So my grandparents, it was a way of life that you had to do all of these things to provide appropriately for your family. And it was just part of being who you were. And then we invented strip malls, which you could argue was not necessarily like the greatest invention to ever come along in the history of American culture. And that somehow sucked in my parents' generation for, you know, 30 years or something like that. And then I think we all came along and we said, strip malls, that's cool and stuff, but like, let's not do that so much. Let's instead go back to things that are authentic and creative and individually produced and have valued that much more. So we're really just riding on the back of a trend that's already started to happen. And what we've tried to do is make the experience as much like learning from your grandma or great aunt or whatever, as much as we possibly could. So you end up developing this interesting relationship with the instructor that you're learning from. There's something magic that happens when that person is right there in your living room or perhaps on your lap, on your laptop, and you feel like you know them very well and they're right there with you. One of my favorite things that happens on a really regular basis at Craftsy is I'm at a conference or a trade show or something like, and I'm walking around with one of our instructors and somebody out of nowhere comes up and gives them a hug. And they're a little taken aback at first because it turns out they have no idea who this person is. But the person is one of their students on Craftsy and feels like they have this very intimate relationship. And I think it's been one of the interesting things as online media has evolved, both in video, and I think this is a reality that extends to podcasts as well, is you end up in a spot where you feel like you have this personal relationship with people who are being very authentic and you've invited into your home.
So you partner with your founders and you decide to build this business. Has it always just been rainbows and unicorns up and to the right every single day while you're with these video cameras shooting quilting and crafting and toll painting? Or has there been some troubles along the road?
Oh, certainly. Every day has been rainbows nonstop. And no bumps and bruises that have come from those rainbows, just pots of gold. It has been every day filled with its own interesting sets of twists and turns, but I'll highlight a couple of the challenges. And in particular, one that I think is resonant with everybody who's an entrepreneur on one dimension or another is that incredibly awkward time at the beginning when you put a product out there in the world that you've spent a bunch of time ideating on and working on and creating, and then nobody shows up to interact with it at all. So we had created this, you know, simple system where every time somebody bought one of our classes, we would get an email. And we were really excited when we launched the product and really eager to see those emails start flying in. And our first office was very close to my house, so I'd walk to work every day. And like, as I was walking to work, I would check my phone, like eagerly anticipating these emails to start coming in. And a couple of days passed and a week passed. And like, my mom had bought a class and that was really nice of her. And John's mom had... her dad had bought a class and, you know, lots of other folks had bought, you know, a few things here and there, but they were all people that we knew. A week plus in, we had nobody who we didn't know buy anything. We were getting really nervous about this. And then finally, one day, a guy bought a class from us who I had never heard of. And I went to the office and asked everybody and nobody had ever heard of this person. And I was so excited. So I sent him an email to find out how he'd found out about us and why he'd bought a class. Never heard anything back from them. And gosh, that was disappointing. And so days and days continue to pass. And eventually, through iteration, we finally found the right mix of the right class experience, the right way to describe the product that we were offering, and the right customer base. And something worked. And we started to get traction from there.
So going off of waiting and waiting, in college, students tend to believe that if you have an idea, you have to build it really fast and then have it, you know, become this not one hit wonder of sorts. And people, I know a lot of students who believe that if they have an idea and it's not successful right away, that they see it as a failure. So with Craftsy, how did you and your teammates hold each other accountable to say that we believe in this idea, we believe in the passion behind it, and continued on even when you felt, you know, the growing pains, and to continue to work towards success?
It's a great question. I come back to the base of the pyramid that I was describing before, in that we all had a ton of respect for each other as co-founders, and felt like what we were doing was going to be important to somebody at some point. We just need to figure out who that was, and that we were going to refine the offering until we got there. And we got lucky in that, well, it wasn't as quick as we wanted it to be. And there were some tough emotional times working our way through that. Within a couple months, we started to get a little bit of traction. And then there was one magical day where we sent an email to a whole bunch of quilters through a partner of ours. And all of a sudden, those emails started coming in at a pace that prompted us to feel like we needed to turn off the emails from coming in. And that was just like the most glorious thing of all time. And then we were off and running. But I completely agree that it's really hard at the beginning to feel like you need to persevere. And that's why when I'm talking to particularly first-time early entrepreneurs, probably the biggest thing that I talk about is that it's really important to find whatever that crazy niche is of people who disproportionately love your product. And it doesn't have to be a scalable group. It doesn't have to be the group that's going to be the end all be all for your business over time. But you know, I think back to very early days of eBay preceding my time there. And most of the revenue for a long time at eBay was Beanie Babies and Pez dispensers. Getting very old now, at MySpace, when they started to build their first real social network that got traction, it was porn stars and then eventually bands, right? At Facebook, it was college campuses. Basically, every business that ends up growing into becoming something meaningful starts with a kernel of some group of people that for some strange reason disproportionately love what you're doing. And you just need to find those people and make sure you're doing a super great job of delivering against their needs.
You've come back to this bottom of the pyramid people a lot. When the four of you decided to start working together, what are the tips of the trade at being an entrepreneur to pick great co-founders? Like, did you go through any process, or was it just like natural? You knew these people. How did you pick the right co-founders?
Yeah, nicely, all of us had worked together in different ways before. And so we knew each other quite a lot. We knew that we worked well together and had a lot of respect for the way each other worked. But even above and beyond that, we knew that we had complementary skills. So one of the nicest things about us as a group was that on day one, when we started, there was no ambiguity about who was going to work on what or how we were going to cover the scope of things that needed to be covered in the business, because we had a group of people who covered the right skill sets appropriately. And so those are the two things that I would most look for. A group of people who you really enjoy being with every day, with a lot of your time every day, for a long period of time during some difficult circumstances. So you have to feel good about that. And then you have to feel good that what they bring to the table is complementary to what you bring, that you all fit together like a nice puzzle.
How would you say that over time, working with three other guys where all of you have different skill sets, how does each person's unique skills create the strong sense of leadership that the company has now?
Yeah. I think the nice news has been that the company has had the opportunity to count on us for different things at different times because we bring very different things. And we bring different things both from a technical perspective or from a functional perspective, but also, not surprisingly, we're different people, right? And so people turn to me for things that they wouldn't turn to Brett for, and they turn to Brett for different things than they would turn to Todd for. And I think that range of human characteristics also ends up being really important to support growth and development of a diverse organization.
So if you were to go back and do it all over again when you were leaving Service Magic, what other resources, and you think, you know, here in Colorado, in and around the university ecosystem, in and around the community, like what are the resources you think that are most valuable to entrepreneurs starting up?
Yeah, so I think two things, mentorship and capital. And I think we were really lucky in this regard because we had worked, John and I had worked together at eBay. And so eBay, at the time that we were there, everything went to crap post 99-2000, and eBay was doing really well. And so it became a magnet for all kinds of talented, interesting people. And somehow they accidentally got me along with that, which, you know, happens from time to time. And so I had the great pleasure of getting to work with some really incredible people who have gone on to do far more interesting things than I've ever done. And the first person who believed in us around Craftsy was this guy, Michael Deering, who's a wonderful person and was John and my boss at eBay and was the first investor in our business and is a sort of super angel institutional investor in the Bay Area. And then our second investor was Jeff Jordan, who's now a partner at Andreessen Horowitz, but also was with us at eBay. And so having those two individuals involved, both for their capital, but more importantly for their advice and guidance and mentorship and their personal connections, was incredibly critical. And I think that as we grow as an ecosystem here in Denver, Boulder, Colorado, more broadly, we need to really focus on making sure that we're giving support to other folks who are coming up in our ecosystem to help them build relationships with other folks who have done interesting things over time, who may have lots of accumulated bumps and bruises, who can help guide them in the right direction, and then also who can help them with access to capital over time as well.
What would you say is the best advice to young entrepreneurs in terms of gaining mentorship?
Ask, in a word. I think that we kind of all get trained out of asking. And I think if there's one thing that the internet has done that has been incredibly impactful in my life, it's made everybody in the world accessible. And so I would, without hesitation, get on LinkedIn or AngelList or whatever your favorite network is of choice where you can discover interesting people and reach out to them. And not everybody will get back to you, but I think you will be shocked by the percentage of people that will be excited about the opportunity to give you time, learn about what you're doing, and try to be helpful and supportive to you. I think if you hunker down and don't ask, you're doing yourself a huge disservice.
That's great, Josh. We really, really appreciate it. Parting thoughts here. You've got a large community of alumni and greater part of the Colorado community and students. When you think about starting up, what's that one unequivocal piece of advice that just keeps you running, whether it's a Craftsy or whatever you're going to do next? Give us that.
Yeah, I think interrelated to a topic I mentioned briefly before, I'd be really focused on making sure that you are building something that is fantastic for a specific group of people, and therefore, probably by definition, uninteresting, boring, worthless to the broader population. So don't try to meet everybody's needs on the mediocre level that you can with limited resources. Try to meet a small group of people's needs exceptionally in a very focused and targeted way. My favorite quick example of this that I think a lot of folks can relate to is what Google has done with Google Sheets. So Google Sheets came out to compete with Excel. Excel is one of my favorite and most used products. I'm a big Excel geek, and there's a bazillion features that I like kind of can't live without. And smartly, brilliantly, I think, what Google did is they didn't try initially to compete with pivot tables and the whole range of fancy-dancy things that Excel is able to do. They focused on collaboration. And that was the one thing that they just crushed. And they believed, and they were obviously right, that Excel and the Office suite in general did a lousy job of collaboration, but there were a whole suite of applications that or needs that consumers had that collaboration was critical for. And so they crushed it on that dimension. And crushing it on that dimension has bought them the time and opportunity to make that product a full-featured product that now can compete head-to-head with Excel or the like. And I think that ends up being a lesson that is extensible to basically everybody's business in one way or another.
Well, thank you, Josh. This has been an incredible episode of the Project Excite sessions. Really appreciate your time. And most importantly, just all the entrepreneur energy you've brought to Denver, to Colorado, and the greater entrepreneur ecosystem. You're a rock star, and we really appreciate it. For all of you who are listening, if you'd like to learn more about what we discussed today, please visit us at projectexcite.org. If you're interested in seeing this totally awesome company here in Denver, Craftsy, you can visit them at craftsy.com, and really encourage you to check both these amazing things out. I'd really like to thank our partner in producing Project Excite Sessions, the Cable Center right here on the University of Denver campus. And that's going to do it for today. So thank you for joining us. And remember, never stop starting up. Project Excite Sessions on the University of Denver campus is produced with our partner, the Cable Center. You can always visit upcoming episodes of Project Excite Sessions at projectexcite.org.